Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Easy Conversations podcast, a podcast about having easy conversations, where we talk about mental health, adversity, spirituality, and societal issues. I'm your host, Furkan Dandia. And join me on this heartwarming episode of the podcast where I welcome the renowned author and kindness advocate, Alan Questel. In this special episode, Alan shares his profound insights from the book, Practicing Kindness, and delves into the transformative power of kindness in our lives. Alan is a globally recognized teacher and practitioner of movement and embodiment. He has dedicated his life to exploring the profound impact of kindness on our well-being, relationships, and the world at large. Together, Alan and I engage in a heartfelt conversation about how we can incorporate kindness into our daily routines and interactions, making the world a better place, one act of kindness at a time. In the episode, we explore the concept of kindness and its significance in our lives, practical techniques and exercises we can use for cultivating kindness, the ripple effect of kindness on personal growth and community building, real life examples of how kindness has transformed our lives and the community at large, and the role of mindfulness and self-awareness in practicing kindness. Alan Questel is known for his clarity, creativity, and down-to-earth style of teaching. He brings a depth of understanding, humor, and gentle human perspective while creating lively conditions for learning. Alan has taught thousands of people in over 20 countries on 5 continents. He's also the author of Creating Creativity, Embodying the Creative Process. Alan likes to say he is still discovering how to be kinder to others and towards himself. I really hope you get a lot out of this episode, and if at the end you could leave a 5-star review or comments in the comment section, I would truly appreciate it. And a brief word for our sponsors. So I would like to talk about deodorants because I'm tired of constantly replenishing my deodorant and then having to worry about disposing those plastic containers. There's a solution for that. Wild. Wild provides a eco-friendly, all-natural deodorant with a sustainable design. They provide a for-life aluminum case. For me, they sent me a personalized case with my name on it. And did I mention you can customize your orders and have these refills delivered straight to your door? This is an all-natural solution where there's no aluminum in the product, just in the case. Go to wearewild.com and use code EASY at checkout for 25% off your first order. All right, Alan, welcome to the Easy Conversations podcast. Thank you so much for joining me this morning. Very much appreciate you taking the time, and I'm really looking forward to the opportunity of having this conversation with you. I've been able to review some of your work and have been very, very impressed. So I take it more of as opportunity to be grateful to have this discussion with someone like yourself. But before we get right into it, I do want to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself a little bit and let the listeners know a little bit about your work and what it is that you do, and then kind of go from there.
Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me, and I feel fortunate too. So that's a good thing. And I spent a good part of my life teaching something called the Feldenkrais method, which is a movement technique based on learning theories. And I generally work with people with orthopedic problems, neurological problems, professional athletes, dancers, and people who simply want to improve the quality of their life in some way. And a lot of it revolves around our self-image as well. And actually, at one point, I was putting together a workshop around self-image. And I started to think our self-image was a reflection of how much we like ourselves or how much we don't like ourselves. And after some time, I decided that this was my job, to help people like themselves more. And I do it through the Feldenkrais method. And This work presents a unique opportunity in terms of how to like ourselves, because one part of the work is guided movement sequences that I lead people through, and they're done small and slowly. And the question I started to pose more and more again is, are you moving in a way that you like the way it feels?
Mm.
And because of the context that's not attached to the everyday outcomes of our life, like, we all want to like it. Well, actually, that's a question. Whenever any context I ever teach in, I ask the question, would you like to like yourself more?
Mm-hmm.
And people always give me this kind of sheepish grin where I say, is anyone here not want to like themselves more? And then they laugh because I've never met someone who doesn't want to like themselves more.
Mm-hmm.
So this way of practicing it became something that's been a focus of mine for many years. But I also thought that this is an intrapersonal process, something I do with myself. And then over time, I thought, how can I make it more interpersonal with others? And it actually was preceded, that thought was preceded by me just doing an act of kindness with someone. And in that moment, realizing, I like myself more. Mm-hmm. And so I started getting more interested in kindness. And that actually led me to most of the work I'm doing now and the book that I wrote and our conversation right now, too.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that. And I'm sure we'll explore all of that. But from the get-go, I guess the whole construct of liking ourselves, at the surface, it sounds odd, right? Because it's like, well, what does that even mean? Of course I like myself. Why wouldn't I? And the reason I want to kind of explore that a little bit further is because I see clients who really struggle to like themselves, even though they convince themselves that, no, I do like myself, but it's in the small, and this is coming from completely non-judgmental place because I struggle with that too, but it's in the small actions, daily actions we engage in, or the behaviors we exhibit, but often we will put our own ability to like ourselves in the hands of other people, right? Through people pleasing, through always putting others before ourselves. And sometimes people have this struggle with feeling selfish when they put themselves first, right?
Yeah.
A lot of the time I have to like point out to my clients that you need to keep your cup full before you can offer anything to anyone else. And obviously there's that whole analogy around, you know, putting on your oxygen mask first, but that's kind of the idea there. And so like I said, at the surface, it may seem like, well, what does that even mean? But when you kind of get into the depths of it, not a lot of people do things on a daily basis that would come out as, okay, them liking themselves. So I don't know if that resonates for you, and how does that sound?
Sure. I agree with you 100%. I think it's one of the more challenging things. And sometimes people don't even consider it. They just struggle in their lives and they don't have a sense of what it's related to. And liking ourselves more, as you said, it's like one of the places we do look for that is through others.
Yeah.
The kind of confirmation of who we are, the appreciation. Do others like me? As if they like me, I would like myself more. We also do it through objects and things like, well, I get new clothes or a new haircut or a new partner or a new apartment or a new car. I don't know if you've ever had the chance to purchase a new car, but when you're driving around in a new car, you're kind of really like, this is really cool. And you see someone else with the same new car, you give them a thumbs up, you know. But then a year goes by and all of a sudden the next model comes out. And now you're dissatisfied with this new car a year old that you have, as if it's no longer good enough.
Yeah.
And this is where the external orientation, whether it's with others or towards things, it's not that that's wrong or bad. Those things are useful and they do afford us some sense of liking ourselves more, but it's not generated internally. And that's what I've become interested in, is how do we learn to generate this quality of feeling internally? And I think that one of the more important aspects of being able to do that as a practice is to not have it connected to big outcomes, like a new job or something, like a new partner, things like that. To be able to practice with little things every day, concrete, practical things that kind of seem innocuous. They're kind of like, well, is this really going to help me like myself more? And my experience is, yeah. You know, most of my work now is in Feldenkrais is teaching professional training programs where I train people, and they're 4 years long. And the first time I had this experience was a training I had in Australia where we were practicing this idea of moving in a way that you like the way it feels. And at the end of the fourth year, when they graduated, people came up and I'd give them their certificate and a hug. And I can't tell you how many people whispered in my ear, I like myself more now.
Yeah.
And that kind of made it. But there's something also to consider about liking ourselves more, which is it's not like a finish line that we get to. It's something that we need to keep practicing. And this is the not so good news maybe about being kinder or liking ourselves more is that the better at it that we get, the next hurdle that we look to get kinder or like ourselves more is further away.
Right.
And I found, you know, it's funny because when I wrote the book, I was writing a lot about being kind to others. And when I got to the part about being kind to myself, I got blocked for about 5 years. And I thought I was pretty good at being kind to myself. But it was a revelation, a slower revelation over 5 years to discover I had a lot of work to do that. And it's in those moments when we discover that that's where we need to be especially kind and gentle with ourselves. So not to go, oh, I'm not kind enough yet, or I don't like myself enough, or because those things will come up for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, that makes sense on so many levels, because one of the things I've learned recently through, you know, listening to podcasts as well, but the whole idea of dopamine release in our body, it's released when you're in the pursuit of something rather than when you achieve something, right? And that's kind of the whole notion of liking ourselves too. When we put our ability to feel good enough or worthy on certain materialistic or achievable things in this world, whether it's a relationship, some financial goals, a job title, once you've achieved it, then what? Yeah. And that's where that feeling of emptiness sinks in, right? Like in your example of a car, I was in that situation where I was like, I had all this energy and like excitement for 2 months as I was in that process of purchasing this car I'd been like thinking about for a while. And then the first day I pick it up, I drive it around, get that excitement out. And then as I was parking that night, I just felt empty again because I hadn't taken that time to truly heal myself and have that ability to like myself. And I thought, oh, if once I get this car, I'm going to feel better.
Right.
That feeling only lasted 5 minutes.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but at least you got a new car, you know.
And I think what I realized through that, often looking back too, is you know, again, you want to build something that's sustainable and long lasting, and a lot of that work needs to happen inside rather than outside, as you've described.
You know, when I asked her question, "Would you like yourself more?" And then the next question is, what are the first things that come up for you when you consider that? And most of the time, the first things that come up are all the things we don't like about ourselves. I practiced Zen Buddhism for many years, and I had a teacher who said, we can view our desire to change as an act of aggression towards ourselves. That's a pretty potent statement, because the way we go about wanting to change is with too much aggression. And in fact, if I think about changing, most of the time, what I'm trying to do is to get away or cut out some part of myself. And the problem with getting away from something is that I attach myself to it. Mm-hmm. If I don't like that chair that's across the room, then when I leave the room, I'm always checking back. Where's that chair? Making sure it's far enough away. I could be getting on a plane to another country. I'm still, where's the chairs? Okay, it's there. Good. And so that idea It's a shift in perspective. Instead of trying to get away from something, we need to be able to focus on what do I want to go towards? Mm. Like when I work with people and who have a pain, and of course they want to get rid of their pain, right? And whether it's emotional, physical, or just the pain of who they are, not who they don't want to be anymore. Mm-hmm. And I say, so let's say they have a pain in their neck. And I say, so I ask an important question. What would you like to be better at? Mm-hmm. And you know what? They often say, well, I want to not have pain in my neck. And I go, well, that's good. That's an important thing. But that's what you want to get away from. What do you want to go towards? I can give you a concrete example of this. Years ago, when I started my practice, I was in New York City. And my uncle came to me for sessions. He was a dentist and he had pain in his back. And I'd work with him and the pain would go away. But the next week it was back again. And he's working in a position where he's twisted all the time the same way. And we'd done four or five sessions where he felt better, but it came back. And then I remembered something when he came in. I said, you like golf, don't you? And he went, oh yeah, I love golf. And I said, what do you want to improve in your golf? And we talked about a swing and the power. And after that session where we worked with improving his golf, the pain in his back went away. So it's so evident how the change in perspective takes us somewhere new instead of attaching or connecting ourselves to our past, which we can't change that. So we need another direction usually.
Yeah, yeah. And speaking of that whole idea of pain and not focusing on what you want to move away from, earlier you talked about movement. Mm-hmm. And how can people work through that? Where, like, based on your work, do you feel like there's often restrictions or pain involved? And again, you alluded to the past. Obviously, that's coming from the past. How does liking oneself improve the pain?
Well, it's an investigation over time, okay? Yeah. And if I speak of it in terms of movement, I might be able to give a clearer understanding of it. So I talked earlier about self-image. So one way we can think of our self-image is that it's comprised of four different components: our thinking, our feeling on an emotional level, our sensing, how we take in and process information, and our movement, our actions in the world. And a change in any one of those aspects is the potential to change the other aspects. So if I change how I think, it may change how I feel. If I change how I move, it may change how I think. But if we kind of really look at them and say, well, can I change how I think? Well, of course we can. But it's not such a quick process. Mm-hmm. And to change how we think, we can kind of trick ourselves into like, oh yeah, I think I'm thinking differently. And I've looped right back into my habitual way of thinking. The first time I was in Japan, I was having lunch with this Japanese man who studied linguistics at Harvard University. And we're talking, and every few minutes he would kind of shake his head and go, huh, you're so Western in how you think. And I was so insulted because I thought I was quite Eastern in how I thought. Well, now working many times in Japan, I realize, yeah, I'm quite Western in how I think. So yeah. Changing our thinking is possible, right? Now, can we change how we feel? Well, yeah, our feelings do change. But most of the time when we're investigating ourselves through feelings, I'm feeling too much of something. I don't know what I'm feeling. And the model I like to use is like a baby. A baby's crying and you just jingle some keys in front of their face and they stop crying. And I always joke, I say, well, too bad that doesn't work with adults. I said, but it could if it was the keys to a new car or a new house.
Right.
Right. So we can change how we feel, but this kind of investigation is so mercurial that we can end up one place or another. We don't know how we got there, how to get out of it. Now, to change how we sense, how we process, take in information, this is like a large part of the study of more modern neurology, of trying to make sense out of this thing. So that's way too far away. But to change how we move, how we act in the world is immediate and concrete. We can feel the difference. We can change the thinking behind it, right? Mm-hmm. And so if we do that, if I change my action, that has the potential to change how I think, how I feel. Now, that's a nice explanation. but it doesn't mean it's going to be easy.
Right.
Because when I change how I act in the world, sometimes it feels like this is not me. It feels a bit inauthentic or disingenuous until I practice it enough to go out and do that. And really, it takes courage to do something like the courage. And I would say another word for courage that I like, that because courage also has many different meanings, is the want. How much do I really want to change? Mm-hmm. You know, I can tell you, I've had this experience many, many times where a Feldenkrais practitioner, one of my graduates or someone else, calls me up and says, you know, my practice isn't what I want it to be. And we talk, and I say, well, have you tried this? Yeah, have you tried this? Have you tried this? No. I said, go try that. And they come back 3-4 months later. Well, it's still not working. Same conversation. Have you tried this? Have you tried this? Have you tried this? No, try that. And that usually goes through about 3 or 4 cycles, and it has always gotten to the same place where I say, have you tried this? Yeah. Have you tried this? Yeah. Have you tried this? And they say, oh, I'm not comfortable doing that. Because that's outside their self-image. They can't imagine themselves doing it. But the interesting thing is, the ones who don't do it, it stays the same. But the ones who take that task on, their practice changes. Mm-hmm. So it's like, if you want to like yourself more, if you want to be kinder to yourself, I can predict that you're going to run into some situations that this feels like it's easier maybe just to stay my old self and not do it. But if the want is really strong enough, say, I'm going to do it. I'm going to see if I can make this happen over time, gently, patient. Yeah,
for sure. And, you know, you kind of touched on people getting stuck in the past. And, you know, as you were explaining that whole movement aspect of it, and I started thinking about, you know, some of the work that Peter Levine and Bessel Kolb have done with regards to trauma. Now, I don't want to just bring that focus to trauma, but it could be anything from the past, whether traumatic or not, where often you will get frozen in time is the best way I can explain it. And that often presents itself in certain bodily restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that thing that also happens, or because people often have this internal message from those incidents that I don't like myself because of what happened. I deserved it. There's shame around it. Once they're able to move past it, they feel like this freedom, even in their bodies and in their mood. And often those stored states do present themselves as painful sensations from a somatic perspective too.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'll give you another personal example.
Sure.
So, when I was 19, I moved out of my parents' house, and I had this realization that I'm not good at anything, which was like a big way of not liking myself. I just felt I didn't do anything well. It's kind of funny. I was a failure at 19. 19 isn't old enough to be a failure. I haven't lived long enough. I haven't tried enough things, you know? And I started thinking, well, maybe I could teach myself to do one thing well. And I was just fortunate, or it was maybe happenstance that it worked this way. I decided that, you know, I didn't brush my teeth well. I knew that about myself. And I thought, I'm going to teach myself to brush my teeth well. Now, the thing about that that's really useful, it's an action that I do on a regular basis, hopefully, right? And that no one knows if I don't do it, except maybe the dentist, but he probably already knows, right?
Yeah.
And so I started practicing brushing my teeth every day. And I'd have bad days and good days, but it was something that I could consistently go towards frequently. And then over time, I started to feel an internal sense of accomplishment. It was something I wanted to get better at, and I was able to achieve that. And the result of that was I like myself more. But as I mentioned before, any level of success in these kind of aspects of ourselves, the next one presents itself. So I started to realize that the way I avoided brushing my teeth, the habits I had around not doing it well, were in fact, that's the way I did things in other areas of my life. That's right. The way I studied. That's the way I was in some relationships. And I went, oh, brushing my teeth now seemed easy compared to the idea of encountering this other stuff. But it's, I can tell you, can I read you something?
Sure, sure.
So this is a quote from my book. And, you know, if I think about the things that I talk about in the book in terms of generating more kindness towards ourselves and others, I would say, with some humility, hopefully, that I'm pretty good at these things. That's why I could write about them.
Right.
And when I have a quote in the book, it's from Ram Dass, and he says, when you go out into the woods, you look at trees. You see all these different trees, and some of them are bent. Mm-hmm. You sort of understand that it didn't get enough light, so it turned that way. You don't get all emotional about it. You just allow it. The minute you get near humans, you lose all that. You're constantly saying, you are to this, or I'm to this. This judgment mind comes in. And so I practice turning people into trees, which means appreciating them just the way they are. So the reason this quote is so significant to me is because, as I said, in the book, I can do those things. Right. But that the accomplishment of those things, the next rung on the ladder for me to be kinder seems so far away. It's like, will I ever accomplish that in my lifetime? Mm-hmm. And it's about this quote. So, I mean, I don't think I'm alone that, you know, I could be sitting in an airport and looking at someone and I make up a story about them. Could be a positive story. Could be a negative story. And I try to remind myself of this quote, but you know what? The quote is too long. Mm. I can't reiterate the whole story of what those five sentences, but what I've learned to do is, if I can catch the moment, and that's probably the biggest challenge, is that I catch myself in that moment, making up a story about someone, I go, oh, tree. And I just say tree, and it's like literally, it's like something falls off of them, and I'm just looking at another person, you know? So these things are important, and it's something that's a journey for the rest of our lives. Hopefully, we cross some tipping point where we feel it's worth it. I'm going to keep doing it, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And what I took out of your, you know, brushing your teeth example is just a simple act, right? Just simplifying it, yet being intentional.
Yeah.
And at the same time, like, you know, kind of now moving into the concept of your book, intentional acts of kindness, right?
Yeah.
So what inspired you to write a book about kindness? Because it's something that we often take for granted, right? Everyone says, be kind, do this, do that. But earlier you also mentioned that this whole idea of just being kind to someone else makes you like yourself more.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. How do you differentiate between being kind for the sake of being kind or being kind for the sake of being selfish, like to feel better?
That's a great question. And it's true, because if I say I'm going to do a lot of kind acts so that I like myself more, that's a little bit misplaced.
Yeah.
I think one example of that is in how we can be generous.
Yes.
Like, you know, if you look up the word kindness, it's often equated with generosity. And people say, oh, she's so generous. She's so kind. And I don't think they're necessarily the same thing. They're related for sure.
Yeah.
But I explore generosity quite a bit in the book too, because many of us are generous. We give to get.
Yes.
Right? And so that's a kind of a misplaced motivation. Or let me say it another way. Maybe it's a good motivation if that's where someone needs to start.
Yeah.
And maybe it can transform itself into something that's a little more, a little less self-serving and a little more genuine when we do something like that.
Well, and often, just add on that too. Like, often we can be generous from an arm's length, right? Like, just going online and putting money towards a charity and hitting click. Yes, me being generous, but how am I doing a, you know, directly influencing someone. And often that generosity can be superficial in a way too, right?
Right. Yeah. Look, I think that, you know, clicking on something and giving money to, like today, I just gave money to the cause in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Because of all the fires there. It's just like, oh my God, what a horrible, I mean, one of the worst things I've seen in a long time. So clicking on a button like that, I think it's worthy. But in the everyday realm of being generous, how do we do that?
Yeah.
So when I was writing the book, one of the exercises, because in each chapter of the different things that I write about, I have concrete exercises to practice, to see. Because if you don't have something to practice, it's just an idea. It's a good intention, but it's not concrete enough. Mm. So one idea I came up with was, if you're in a restaurant, let's say, you could do it with an Uber or a taxi or getting your hair cut. But I chose a restaurant that if you tip 20%, for every $5 of the tip, give an extra dollar. Mm. If you can, this always has to be within the realm of what's really viable for someone, right? And so I've been writing about this, and that night I went out to dinner with a couple of friends, and I picked up the check, and it was $70. And I usually tip 20%, so I thought, okay, that's $85. And I had a $100 bill in my pocket, and I thought, I'm going to give the $100. And you know what happened in the next moment? I clutched. I was like, I can't do that. That's too much. That's crazy. What are you thinking? And then I caught that and I went, do it. Because $15 to me, I could live with giving an extra $15.
Yeah.
Now, the really great thing was when I got to the exit, when as I was leaving, the waitress came up to me and said, you just made my night. Mm-hmm. And I realized that that kind of generosity was something that I could practice. And so when I go out to dinner, I still encounter this little glitchy moment of, is that too much? And I thought, do it. Like I was in one restaurant, and I have to say the service was terrible. The main dishes came before the appetizers, and we had to wait for everything. They brought the wrong drinks. It was like, this is crazy. And look, what if we all do something like that? So I'm just going to give a crummy tip.
Yeah.
What I did was I called the waiter over at the end, and I said, listen, I have to tell you something. I said, I'm going to give you a good tip tonight, but the service was terrible. Terrible. And I listed the things and I said, I'm not going to punish you by giving you a bad tip, but I'm informing you that you need to pay more attention for something like that. Now, that's not an easy thing to say. It's easier to walk out and give a crummy tip, you know? But I thought, if I'm really helping other people be better people, they need feedback. They need to understand something, you know? And you asked me a few minutes ago about part of the motivation of the book. And as you remembered that I thought that, well, with every act of kindness, I think I like myself a little bit more. But there was another motivator, and probably a bigger personal one. That was many years ago, my father and I were never close, and we didn't have a bad relationship, but it was kind of neutral. You know, maybe we spoke once a month, once every 2 months, and it was just nothing with any real sense of connection that I felt. And at some point, he ran out of money, and my brother and I had to support him. And fortunately, we could help, which was good. And then he developed dementia. And he was remarried, and we had to put him in a home because she could no longer take care of him. Yeah. And the home was in Florida. He was from New York, and the summer was coming, and I realized my stepmother was going to New York for the summer, and all his friends were going to be leaving. And I thought, he's going to be completely alone. No one's going to visit him. So I got it in my head to call him every day. I don't know where the idea came from. Yeah. And I started calling him every day. I lived in California at the time. And so the time difference kind of worked out. When I woke up, it was early morning for him, and he was in his room. And we would talk every day. Now, talk. Sometimes it was gibberish. Sometimes he took the phone and turned it the wrong way. So he had the speaker to his ear and he couldn't hear anything. But he always recognized who I was.
Yeah.
Sometimes he'd put the phone down and walk away. But I did that every single day for 3 years. And if I went like to a meditation retreat or something where I couldn't call, I felt worried, guilty, like what's, well, he couldn't really remember the days, so it didn't matter, you know? And even when he finally passed, for several months, I'd wake up in the morning and reach for the phone and realize, oh, now, what I call that an act of kindness 5 minutes a day. And it sounds like an easy thing, but you know what? It's not.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. In writing the book, I thought, I'm going to practice this with my dog. Give him 5 minutes every day. Good luck.
Yeah,
thank you. I was like, I'm going to go check my email. I'm going to go do this or water the plants or something, you know? And it was a hard thing to really sustain. And now in my life, I have a few people and it changes over time. Some of them are very old. Some of them are young, who are struggling in their lives, either not well in some way or lonely in some way. And I go out of my way to call, not every day, but once a month I call them.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you how often they say, oh, I'm so happy you called. No one really calls me anymore. You know? And I thought, huh, if we all did that with just one or two people in our lives, I think that could change the whole world.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah. Yeah. And what I, you know, thank you for sharing that story. And you know, what I've come to realize over time, whether it's kindness or generosity, you know, we talked about being generous financially a little bit, but at the same time, you can be generous even through with your time, which I believe is one of our most precious commodities in this world.
Absolutely.
Right. With our time, with our knowledge, with just through service and all these little acts of kindness, you never know how it's going to impact someone. One of the things I've come to realize is, over, you know, because I've spent this time on working on myself and just gaining more humility, I feel like people come to me now and just even in the most random situations, like people just feel comfortable sharing their whole life story. And sometimes I'm like, I'm not working right now. I'm just here trying to relax, have a nice relaxing evening. And, you know, I'll take on yours too. But, As much as it can be like, oh, I just want a break from talking about these things, I realize like just looking at the other person, the impact it's having on them and how much relief they're feeling and how grateful they are that someone was just there to listen. And we've lost that, right? Because we're glued to our screens, we're running from meeting to meeting, we're catching an Uber to get to the airport, whatever it is, we've lost that sense of humanity and connection.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know how often, like, because I'm even on my phone at times trying to get an email out or whatever, you miss that opportunity to make eye contact with someone you're transacting with, right? That alone, to me, could be kindness, just making that eye contact and treating them like as a human.
I think that's huge. And the key word in what I heard in what you said, for me at least, was listen.
Mm-hmm.
Just listen to someone. Because if you differentiate yourself working with people where you have to listen to them, but you also have to respond to them, you have to help them, direct them, guide them, and send, like, facilitate something. But if I'm in an outside of work situation and someone starts talking to me, I don't have to do that. I can just listen. Now, doesn't mean I don't do that. I may give them an idea or something, but listening is essential. And, you know, I think of, there's a couple of aspects of listening, and one, which is something that we can all do every day, is what I call intentional chit-chat. Because we all have moments together all day with people.
Yeah.
My best friend was a neuroscientist. He just passed away, unfortunately. But he was great at this. And the first time I saw him do this was many, many years ago. We both lived in New York and we were at the bank. And as he came to the front of the line, he said to the teller, he said, "So, how's your day going?" And I remember I looked up like, what? Who's he talking to? And then I realized it was the teller. And I was a little puzzled. The teller, her first response was like that. And then she said, "Pretty good." And they had a few exchanges like that. And I said to him afterwards, I said, where'd you learn to do that? And he said, I don't know. So I started practicing that. And so it's just taking that. And I'm not talking about, hope you're having a good day. You know, it's kind of this thing that we just say by rote. You know, it's really just taking a moment and saying, how's your day going? Mm-hmm. You know, like I went to the tailor to pick something up yesterday. I said, how's it going? And I knew she had a little girl. I said, how's your little girl doing?
Yeah.
2 minutes, you know, that makes someone feel heard and seen and acknowledged. And that generates it more towards others that they might do something like that, you know, and that ability to connect with someone. So we talk about listening, but we can also look at it as just a moment of connection that's genuine. Now, you know, sometimes people who are introverts say, oh, no, I'm not going to do that. You know,
Yeah. That's
way too tough for me. And I go, of course, I'm not suggesting you have to do something like that. But if you're interested, if you have the want to be more connected to other people and you feel that you can't do it publicly like that, what about doing it on the phone?
Mm-hmm.
When you talk to an airline or a helpline or something, you just say, someone says, hi, United Airlines, what can I do for you? I said, well, how are you feeling today?
Yeah.
They're always a little taken aback, but you know what? Now, this isn't the reason to do it, but you always get better service when you connect with someone like that. Or if I'm on a helpline where, you know, they're trying to figure something out for my computer and it's going on for a long time, I finally start saying, like, so where do you live? Where are you calling from? And we talk about different places and the weather, but I tell you, it makes a huge difference. So what you propose there, I think, is really important.
Yeah. When again, it comes back to that whole intentional aspect, right? And that's kind of what you, at least I feel like the essence of even the title of your book, right? It's being intentional. And one of the things I try to remind myself very much, like yourself here, when I'm interacting with people who are either doing the phone calls or service work, is how many people are actually stopping to ask them how they're doing. Meanwhile, they're serving everyone. Yeah. No one asked them how they're doing. And I'm like, maybe I can do that and hopefully it'll change their day.
Yeah.
The best case scenario, right? So I think it's just reminding ourselves that there are people around us always serving and doing something, but people rarely inquire about how they're doing, you know,
what's
going
and
on.
Most of the people who are calling those helplines are angry and frustrated and blaming them. And this poor person's on the receiving end of like, I didn't make that phone. I can't, you know, what's the problem? I'm trying to help you here, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, sometimes they don't help so well because they're reading a script or something like that. But, and there, we need to practice a bit of patience, you know? And it's not just when I think of patience, I don't think I'm patient with others. I'm patient with myself when I'm with others, you know, and that's my own level of frustration. Now, the final thing is the people who irritate me, the people who I get really impatient with, the people who I'm frustrated by, and I have to be careful about saying this because I don't need to invite more. I realize these are my best teachers.
Mm-hmm.
These would normally be the people I would avoid. But you know, you see an email from someone and you go, oh, geez, I got to do it. Or you see the phone message, that calling, like, I'm not going to talk to that. And it's like, those are the ones that can be our best teachers. We can really learn a lot from those difficult, challenging situations.
Yeah.
If we want, yeah.
Absolutely. It's being open and receptive to all of it. But yeah, no, Alan, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much. Is there any final words you'd like to add that you feel it would be of value to the listeners that we haven't covered in terms of the work you do or anything that's, you know, been coming up for you that you'd like to share with us?
Like I said, the most important thing is the want. If you really want something, then to be able to give yourself time, be patient and kind to yourself to let it develop over time, you know, and that being kind to ourselves, can change our lives, and certainly being kind to others can change the world. So that's the whole reason I wrote the book, to hopefully say, let's all join in on this and see if we can get more of us doing it. So
yeah. Yeah. And how can people really, like, and, you know, kind of coming back full circle, the whole notion of being kind to ourselves, right? And I chuckle a little bit, but I shouldn't. It's funny. A lot of the clients who have never had that role model for them, and I'll ask them, I'm like, okay, well, what does self-care look like for you? And often they'll say, oh, maybe it's taking a bath. Maybe it's going, getting my nails done, or maybe going on a trip. I'm like, yes, those are great things. Do them. But maybe sit with yourself and be present. Perhaps try some mindfulness. That's really, in my mind, self-care. Yeah. And just, you know, you kind of say that and they're like, oh, I've never looked at it that way. Right. It's interesting how people just have this relationship of, and how they even look at kindness for themselves. Yeah.
I could add something to that, I think, because, you know, I mean, the idea of mindfulness, I'm all for it, 100%. Yeah. It's not so easy.
No.
I mean, you know, it's not so easy. So some people struggle with that. But I can give another perspective. So, and this is where people like want someone else to do something for them. Like, I wish my partner would make me coffee in the morning.
Yeah.
I'm, you know, I wish, and there's a grumble about it. I can go on for years, you know?
Yeah.
And I thought, well, if you think of the things you want others to do for you, can you do those things for yourself? And that's when someone says, oh, that's too self-serving, narcissistic, I can't do that. But in fact, if you start doing it for yourself, you don't need that person in that way. And then you can look at that person differently. And maybe you end up going, I'm going to make coffee for them too. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, they're kind of surprised. They're like, what are you doing? I said, well, I made myself coffee. I thought you might like some too. Right. And that's the dynamic. That's the action that changes something. And it's always through action that those changes have to happen over time. You know, can I tell you one more story about something?
Of course.
Yeah. So here's a change in action. So my mother passed away when I was pretty young, my 20s. And some months later, I was with my dad in my parents' bedroom watching TV. And I thought, I never tell my dad I love him. Mm. And I did when I was younger, of course, but I thought, I'm going to tell him I love him. And a commercial comes on, and I kind of mustered up some courage. Dad, you know, I want you to know I love you. And he went, I love you too. What's on channel 4? What's on channel 5? And I was like, oh my God, I just bared my soul. And this guy's like changing the channels, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there upset for like an hour. And then I realized, wait a minute, I did this for me to know that I said it, not to get something back.
Mm.
And here's what changed. Over the next year, took about 6 or 7 months, maybe, I was on the phone with my dad, and I said, okay, well, goodbye, I love you. And he went, love me too. And I thought, did I hear that? I wasn't even sure. And then he started saying it. So when we change our actions towards with others, that is the beginning, possibly and hopefully, of them changing their actions as well.
Right, right.
All about how we act, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, again, what I take out of that is that kindness. Are you doing it for something in return?
Right.
And is it even like sometimes when we're kind to a stranger, it's like, oh, he didn't say thank you, right? Like if I'd let someone in while driving and they want to merge, you let them in, it's like, did that person say thank you? Did they wave thank you?
Right. Yeah.
So again, it's that expectation of, are you doing it for yourself or are you doing it just because it is important without the appreciation? And how does that make one feel? So I appreciate that story.
Yeah.
Alan, thank you so much again for coming on here and having this conversation with me. Very much grateful, like I said earlier, but I do want to give you an opportunity if listeners want to find your work or learn more about your book. What are some ways that?
So there's a website, practicing-kindness.com, and that's all about the book. And there's samples of the book and a sample worksheet that helps you guide you through the process. And it's sold on Amazon as a paperback, as a Kindle. I like to say a Kindle instead of Kindle. And also as an audio book. And if you're interested in the Feldenkrais method, I have a few websites, but you can go to uncommonsensing.com.
Perfect. Well, thank you again, Alan.
And thank you. I really enjoyed our conversation, and thanks a lot.
Thank you for checking out this episode with Alan. As always, please leave a review or a comments in the comment section. I always love hearing from you. Or subscribe to the podcast if you haven't done so on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And please check out the sponsors of the podcast. Thank you again, and until next week.